Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is The Iranian Embassy Siege, Part 4. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight.
Chapter 7, London Bridge.
Dorneywood is an 18th century country house near Burnham in Buckinghamshire. It's the holiday retreat of the UK Home Secretary, who in May 1980 was William Whitelaw. Post-lunch drinks and small talk were in full swing in the drawing room, where the Home Secretary was hosting a private function for business leaders. An urgent telephone call came through from the police. Shots have been fired inside the embassy. Whitelaw calmly and quietly apologised to his guests and was quickly escorted out of the front of the residence, where Jack Liddard, his ministerial chauffeur, had his Jaguar 4.2-litre waiting. Along with police motorcade, the car shot out of the gates through the streets of Burnham and Slough and onto the M4 motorway at breakneck speed. Liddard averaged more than 120 miles per hour for the duration of the journey, driving the wrong way up Constitution Hill between Hyde Park Corner and Buckingham Palace. The car came to a loud screeching halt outside the Cabinet Office. The 35-mile journey, which went through central London, had taken just 18 minutes. In the Cobra meeting room, Whitelaw was met by Metropolitan Police Commissioner David McNee and Brigadier Peter de la Billière. The Director of Special Forces reported that both Rose and Dello believed that the sounds recorded from the field telephone indicated someone had been shot inside the embassy. But Whitelaw would not give any assault the go-ahead unless he was certain that lives had been lost. For all Whitelaw knew, the gunman could be bluffing, playing devil's advocate with the negotiators. So until there was suitable proof, negotiations should continue. There remained insufficient evidence to establish that a killing had taken place. The SAS were on standby with a firm plan in place, but there was no guarantee that it would work. There were too many factors that complicated the scenario at hand. If things go well, we must expect between 40 to 60% of the people in the building to become casualties. Anything less than that will be a good outcome. The decision to go in must be a political one, even though it leads to the use of military force, de la Billière affirmed to Whitelaw. Whitelaw responded, "Peter, I want you to understand 2 things. The first is that if and when the operation is launched, I will not interfere in any way. The second is that if it goes wrong, I will take the responsibility afterward in full." Back at the embassy, the hostages were gripped by a crippling and numbed tension. Douglas Hurd was still negotiating with foreign ambassadors, holding talks with the Algerian ambassador, even though he sensed it was entirely pointless. The talks were merely a formality, going through the motions so the press could report that a diplomatic effort was continuing, and thus keep the terrorists thinking that they were getting what they desired. At exactly 5:30 in the afternoon, SAS Commander Rose informed Dello that B Squadron was, quote, at 10 minutes readiness for a full assault. This message came into Zulu base just as Dello was informed of three separate snippets of conversation recorded from inside the embassy by the bug inside the field telephone. These were translated from the Arabic and immediately rushed to Dello. The conversations went something like this. We do something before sunset. Kill two or three or four. Kill all by 10 o'clock. These comments were a further cause for concern.
Ademhun Kolohum, I will execute them all.
It was Faisal. Salim rang the police negotiator, ranting, barely coherent. I have changed my mind. If they don't tell me something in 2 minutes, a hostage will be killed, he said abruptly. Then he hung up. At 6:41 p.m., the front door of the embassy opened slightly. A corpse wrapped in an orange blanket was rolled out and the door closed again. Salim called the police negotiator. There's a body on the doorstep. You can come and collect it. Another one in half an hour. All hostages will die, he said, emotionless. The body that was rolled out of the embassy was stiff with rigor mortis, and the head wound was blood dry. This hostage had been killed more than an hour ago. This meant that the shots he had over the field telephone after the initial three could have been more hostages being killed. Dello had to draw the line. He was usually incredibly unflappable, the calmest man in the room, always. But in this moment, his hand shook as he picked up the telephone. Dello knew that what he was about to do could cause the deaths of a lot of people. But one hostage was dead, and he suspected there may be more dead hostages inside the embassy. People were dying anyway. He needed to act, and act now. Dello dialed a number for Scotland Yard and advised the Commissioner of Police that in his opinion, quote, the circumstances that dictate a military assault have now been obtained. Commissioner David McNee informed the Home Secretary right away in the Cobra meeting room. Whitelaw called the Prime Minister. The Home Secretary's call was patched through to Margaret Thatcher, who was in her car somewhere in the Chiltern Hills, northwest of London. She was returning from Chequers, the Prime Minister's country residence. Thatcher picked up at 7:01 p.m. The hostages' lives are now at risk. I want your permission to send in the SAS, Whitelaw said. Thatcher coldly and sharply replied, yes, send them in now. St. Stephen's Hospital received a call from Zulu base at 7:08 p.m. and was told to clear an entire casualty ward and to place all available medical staff on high alert readiness. They weren't told why. Back at the embassy, Salim, Faisal and Hassan had started adding extra furniture to the barricades behind the doors and windows. They soaked each of the barricades in flammable liquid, paraffin, white spirit and gasoline from the embassy generator, as well as highly flammable duplicator fluid for the photocopiers and telex machines. The blockades were drenched. Over the radio, Hector Gullen, this is Zulu Control. You have full control. Zulu Control told all of their police snipers to stand down and withdraw their weapons. All officers on the ground were told to step back. Information was sparse, but the police suspected that something was about to happen. Intelligence officer Graham Collins stated that he felt the air was electric. There was extreme tension. You could feel something huge was on the cusp. Zulu Control issued a blanket order to all police officers, snipers, medical staff on site and intelligence officers. Put on gas masks with immediate effect and get under the desks. At 7:10 p.m, Hector Gullen gave the code word to prepare and await to go in, into the radio handset. Quote, bank robbery. Four abseilers pulled their ropes through the carbiners at the roof position. The rear assault team moved to a basement position to the rear of the building. Another team gathered on the first floor window of number 15, the building next door, ready to climb onto the exterior balcony. Outside of the embassy and across the street, television reporters had erected scaffolding with powerful lighting so they could illuminate the building at night. The scaffolding had been set up on the second day of the siege by the American television channel CBS in conjunction with the BBC. The SAS team were given the instruction to issue a single warning to all reporters to leave. Then they were to blow up the scaffolding with plastic explosives. To the disappointment of the SAS team who moved into position, the lighting rig was not manned or switched on, so they took no action. All press were ordered to turn off their cameras and cease broadcasting. However, both the BBC and ITV had alternative cameras set up on adjacent buildings with a full front view of the embassy. Sensing something was up, the news stations switched to those cameras and began broadcasting live. The final of the Snooker World Championships was being televised on BBC One when it was interrupted by an urgent bulletin.
This is a BBC news bulletin. We are going live to the Iranian embassy in London, where it seems the Metropolitan Police are taking some sort of action.
The field telephone in the embassy rang at 7:12 p.m. The police negotiator wanted to talk to Salim about the bus that was coming to take them all to the airport. Were the police finally giving in and giving the gunmen everything that they wanted? Well, in a word, no. Whilst the police had been calmly negotiating for 6 days, they were now instructed to keep Salim on the telephone and talking. It didn't matter what about. This was because the SAS were about to detonate a bomb in the central stairwell and bring a holy hell of glass, metal and mortar down on top of his head in the ground floor hallway. All teams were in position. All explosives were primed. Abseilers were hitched and ready. The roof team held their detonators at the get-go. Commander Gullen barked the go order over the radio. London Bridge. At 7:23 p.m., the Iranian embassy rumbled and shook with an enormous explosion.
Chapter 8. 660 seconds.
The following events are a series of instances that happened at overlapping points across a period of just 11 minutes. 660 seconds of intense, fast action. The roof team pushed off the rear parapet. They abseiled down the 30 feet and landed on the rear second floor balcony. One of the abseil team rappelling down the front of the next door building got snagged and stuck. A frantic rush to free him ensued before the team could be discovered. "Go, go, go," Gullen shouted down the radio. Two soldiers crouching behind the lip of the central shaft squeezed their clackers simultaneously. Some 20 feet below, 2.5 pounds of plastic explosive detonated in the central void, blasting out the internal windows and sending more than a ton of glass, iron, wood, plaster and brickwork cascading down into the entrance hall. The explosion could be heard across the city. Six soldiers climbed down through the skylight into the attic. The roof team threw CS gas grenades and flashbangs into the acrid cloud of dust and smoke belching from the embassy's central shaft. They then lowered caving ladders, hooked them over the roof railings and quickly descended. The void was just a black pit full of thick black smoke. Visibility was zero. On the first floor landing, Salim dropped the telephone and staggered back as the surprise of the explosion startled him. Debris crashed past him into the hallway below. Sim Harris stumbled through a doorway and into the Charged Affairs office. PC Trevor Locke stared at Salim for a split second. The policeman didn't hesitate or think twice. Locke charged into Salim's left hip, barging him full force, with both men crashing into the half-open door of Roya Kagachi's office. Locke landed heavily on top of the surprised gunman. Salim's machine gun flew out of his hand and slid across the floor, under an empty desk. Up in the telex room, Hassan felt the building shake and creak from the explosion. Then came the flashbang detonations down the hall, growing closer and closer. A group of the hostages had crouched against the wall, covering their heads. Hassim took a step forward and screamed at them. "Now I have a chance to get you, Afruz." He opened fire with his Scorpion machine gun, spraying the group in long bursts, spraying bullets left to right. Maki joined Hassan by firing his Browning into the group of hostages. The hostages scrambled to take cover under desks, chairs, and behind the telex machines. Abbas Falahi, the doorman to the embassy, felt a dull thump of pain to his upper thigh, and he immediately twisted into a heap on the floor. At that exact moment, an SAS marksman fired two CR gas rounds with Polecat launchers from a position in the street outside. The canisters smashed through the windows, spun on the floor, hissed and detonated. The walls shook. The bang was deafening. Six bullets pounded into Ahmad Dodgar, an embassy medical advisor. A bullet entered in his chest, back, arm and leg, and two in his side. Afruz, the senior Iranian diplomat at the embassy, dived for cover as a bullet clipped his nose and a second buried itself in his leg. Ali Tabutabi, a banker who was at the embassy on official business, saw Maki turn toward him. He raised his pistol and fired. Bullets thudded into his chest and shoulder. Ali left the four women, unattended and screaming. They were left in the cipher room as he ran down the corridor to the telex room. Thick toxic smoke billowed up from the floors below. Ali was greeted by a scene of bloody carnage. Ahmad Dodgar was lying in a pool of his own blood, fighting to breathe. Ali Akbar Samadazadeh, a temporary press assistant at the embassy, lay dead on the floor next to him. Maki had opened fire as he was crawling on his knees, trying to hide beneath a desk. The bullets had entered his buttocks and travelled the length of his body, hip to skull, killing him instantly. The first SAS soldier leapt over the first floor balcony at the front of the building. The live television cameras capturing the moment the mysterious, darkly clad operatives made the entry to the embassy. He was followed by a second soldier carrying a frame charge. The operative placed the square charge in the window and wedged it firmly in place with a batten of wood, cut to length. Surprisingly, and out of nowhere, the curtains opened, and the soldiers who were preparing to blow a hole in the window came face to face with a thin, pale, spectacled figure peering out at them. Sim Harris, in all of the commotion and noise, had stumbled into an open door. The curtains in the room were drawn, but a thin strip of light broke through. Harris felt his way toward the light, through all the smoke and tear gas, his eyes streaming and burning. He opened the curtains. On the balcony stood what he could only describe as a jet-black frogman, a heavily armed soldier wearing a gas mask and a peculiar black jumpsuit. He was pointing a machine gun right at him. The frogman screamed at Sim Harris, "Get the fuck down!" Harris ducked backwards deeper into the room. The two SAS operatives didn't hesitate. They leapt back across onto the next balcony from which they had came and detonated the frame charge. A huge explosion blew a hole in the wall 6 feet wide. Half the balcony disappeared with it. Rubble and stone pelted the street below. The frame charge was set to blow out the glass in the window. The glass was reinforced, hence the explosives. But the soldiers weren't sure how strong the glass would be, however, so they used the maximum amount of plastic explosives that they could pack into the frame charge. The blast took the window, the frame, a large chunk of the wall, and half of the balcony with it. The soldier who was abseiling down the front of the building and had got snagged dangled on the rope. He was stuck and couldn't break free. He shouted to his teammates on the roof to cut the rope. Below him, another operative smashed through a balcony window into the general office, throwing two L-29s and a stun grenade. He followed the grenades inside, along with two more soldiers. The room was empty. But they could hear voices of terrified women in the next room. But the door was locked and barricaded. An operative fired a burst of bullets into the lock, but the barricade kept it securely shut. The flashbangs had by now set fire to the barricade, which was of course soaked in paraffin. The three men climbed back out of the window as the curtains and furniture in the room ignited. Two floors above, Hassan leaned out of the window and began firing his pistol at the SAS operative who was snagged on the rope. Unfortunately for Hassan, SAS snipers were providing cover from the building across the street. The sniper saw Hassan hanging out of the fourth floor window through his telescopic sight. He aimed and squeezed the trigger. The soldier hanging from the front of the building was stuck fast and firm. The rope was knotted into the metal loops of the abseiling device. The office below had caught fire and was now fully ablaze, and the flames were raging out of the window and licking at the soldier, who could do nothing but try and push himself away. But he only swung back, giving temporary relief from the fire. At this point, a six-man SAS team broke through the front door of the embassy with sledgehammers and entered unchallenged into the entrance hallway. Flashbangs, tear gas, smoke grenades all exploded. The first soldier inside could see a telephone wire leading under a doorway into an office, so he fired a blast of bullets into the door and plaster wall, hoping to hit anyone on the other side. PC Trevor Locke and Salim fought and wrestled on the office floor. Locke pounded with his fists into Salim's head, punching and kneeing his stomach. Next door, the sound of the window being blown out shook the walls and floor. Locke angrily screamed at Salim. "You caused this, you bastard. I fucking begged you to surrender, and you wouldn't. This is all your fucking fault." Salim was much smaller than Locke, both in height and weight. Locke had the upper hand. Salim struggled and tried to reach for his gun, but all 217 pounds of Locke pinned him to the floor. "You fucking cunt, I told you, I gave you alternatives, but you wouldn't fucking listen," Locke screamed in Salim's face. Then, out of nowhere, PC Locke pulled his gun from the holster and jammed it into Salim's temple. Shock, astonishment and surprise came over Salim as he immediately stopped struggling. Salim couldn't believe that Locke had a gun all this time. "You didn't have to do this," Locke continued to shout. "I told you what would happen if you surrendered peacefully." "It wasn't me," Salim said gently, now full of fear. "It was the others." For a week, Salim had threatened to kill Locke and the other hostages. But now the tables had turned and Salim had become weak and feeble. Trevor Locke moved the revolver to beneath Salim's jaw. He could blow his head off. But Locke paused. He wasn't a killer, he thought to himself. But Salim pleaded with Locke. "Please, don't hurt me, Mr. Trevor. Please." The SAS teams began sweeping the building simultaneously from the top down and the bottom up, with additional teams entering through mid-building windows. The building rocked with each stun grenade explosion, and the thick black smoke and tear gas was acrid and dense. The battle for Prince's Gate was raging on the first and second floors as the SAS teams entered and cleared each room. "I'm bleeding," groaned Ghulam Ali Afrooz. "I've been shot." Blood poured from his wounds in his right leg. The gunmen ceased firing. Maki, Ali and Abbas paused as a volley of gas canisters clattered through the window and exploded. The three terrorists put down their guns. Maki dropped his automatic pistol while Abbas threw a grenade and a gun out of the window. Four SAS operatives quickly moved along what remained of the first floor balcony towards the smoking hole in the wall of the embassy. Two of the soldiers each threw a stun grenade through the hole in the wall and jumped into the office. Through the smoke, the soldiers saw a pair of legs sticking out of the debris. A soldier grabbed Sim Harris off the floor, hauling him to his feet. "Don't panic, just stay down," the soldier shouted to Harris. The soldiers moved forward quickly out into the landing. "Go on, lads, get the bastards," Harris shouted after them. On BBC One television, the John Wayne movie Rio Lobo was interrupted by a news bulletin as the reporter at the scene, Kate Ady, showed the burning embassy. BBC Two had cut from the Snooker World Championship finals to broadcast another angle of the assault.
At 7 o'clock, armed police moved in front of the embassy. Two men ran forward with a stretcher and went into the porch. A body was put on the stretcher and, under cover from the marksman, taken out towards an ambulance. Then Scotland Yard told the waiting press that three shots had been fired and a hostage had been killed. There were no details at that time as to who the man was or to why he'd been killed. The atmosphere seemed calm, with just a little tension in the air. Then some men were seen heading across from adjacent balconies on the first floor.
That was a bomb. That was a bomb.
Explosion ripped through the building, a pall of smoke covering the front of it. The SAS had moved in. After a second explosion, smoke obscured the front of the embassy again. And then there was gunfire. It seemed to come from all around the building. By this time, the police and the press nearby were told to take cover, and they scrambled behind cars and equipment. Shots rang out all over the street. The two explosions caused a fire, and flames were seen on the first floor. Meanwhile, people were still taking cover in the streets outside and no one was moving towards the building. The SAS were inside. The first hostage to come out was BBC sound recorder Sim Harris. He scrambled from the balcony into the adjacent building. The embassy by then was surrounded by activity and a seeming confusion. The emergency services moved closer.
Millions of people across the UK tuned in to witness the longest news flash in British television history. Millions more around the world also watched. Everyone was at home in the United Kingdom as the assault was happening on a bank holiday. In the Cobra meeting room, William Whitelaw made another call to Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. "The assault is going ahead. I'm afraid we are expecting casualties," he said. Thatcher's response was simply, "Okay, continue until the situation is resolved." The operatives moved along the dark corridor on the first floor toward the ambassador's office. They kicked open the door and each threw in a stun grenade. One of the soldiers immediately saw a figure in a combat jacket and a keffiyeh. He fired a burst of bullets from the doorway. Abbas had been hit and was bleeding. He shouted, "Please," to the soldiers, before one of them poured another barrage of bullets into his chest and face. The soldier on the roof severed the rope, a single slash with a knife from his vest, as the sergeant swung back towards the flames. He fell 10 feet onto the balcony, landing hard on his shoulder. His leg was blackened up to the knee with third-degree burns, and his boot partially melted into his foot. But, nonetheless, he sprang to his feet, running purely on adrenaline. He jumped through the window and into the embassy. Entering the embassy, he came across Mackie right away. He was trying to start a fire when the operative spotted him. The soldier tossed in a stun grenade and fired a single burst of bullets. Mackie returned fire with a single gunshot. In the telex room, Faisal frantically emptied his pockets of all bullets and tried to throw his machine gun out of the window. The gun bounced off a desk and landed by the wall instead. Abbas Falahi climbed onto a desk and began waving a white pillowcase out of the window. A tear gas canister struck the doorman in the chest and he was blasted backwards into the room. Ali dropped his Browning and dived onto the floor. He crawled through the smoke in amongst the Iranian hostages and discarded his kefir. Mackie stood in the middle of the room, struck by panic and shell shock. Sim Harris was in a room engulfed in flames. The flaming curtains crackled and whirled in the heat. Suddenly, the heavy curtain gave way and crashed to the floor in a cloud of sparks and acrid black smoke. Harris knew that he had to get the hell out of there. He clambered out and peered over the edge of the stone balcony. The burning curtain billowed over his head as particles of scorching debris rained down and burned his hair. To his left, Harris could see the next balcony along the building outside Royer's office. It was just a few feet away, and there was a flagpole between the two balconies. He could easily jump that and get in through the next office, he thought to himself. PC Locke had Salim pinned to the floor, his revolver jammed into his chin. Locke didn't want to shoot him, but he couldn't see a way out of this situation, and he may have to, he thought. Just then the door opened a few inches, and two round objects clattered into the room. Both Locke and Salim stared at them. They looked like two limes, green metal balls. Then they exploded with a blinding flash, ejecting CR gas into the small room. The force of the blast and the crippling volume knocked Locke sideways, and he rolled off Salim and removed his grip from his throat. He couldn't breathe. His eyes were burning raw and fiery hot. Locke could barely see a thing, but through the smoke, tears, and in the darkness, he could just about make out Salim crawling away and reaching for his machine gun. But Locke didn't have time to react. The door burst open, and a jet black frogman stepped into the room. "Trevor, fucking move away," yelled the soldier. He immediately recognized Locke from studying photos of all the hostages before the assault. Locke rolled to the right. Salim stood up quickly, his machine gun in hand. He reached out with his hand, gesturing to stop. The SAS operative put the first bullet into his right eye, then a diagonal burst across his chest. The final bullet pierced Salim's heart and killed him instantly. A second soldier entered the room and also opened fire and pounded five bullets into Salim's head from just 2 feet away. Salim fell back into the fireplace. For good measure, the first soldier fired another burst of seven shots into Salim's throat, head and shoulder. There was no blood, just holes. The assault raged on and fire billowed out of the front of the embassy. A massive hole punctured through the wall. Machine gun fire, screaming, and the bangs of flash grenades and tear gas echoed from the building. Smoke and tear gas poured from the hole in the wall and through the windows, many of which had been blown out. The chaos was being televised around the world. Never before had the black silhouettes of the UK Special Forces been seen in public, let alone broadcast on international television. There was another huge explosion, and flames burst from the roof. Explosions and gunfire, smoke, fire, bangs, screams, barking dogs, shootings. It was utter chaos. It was a concentrated war zone in the heart of London. In what the Sunday Times called the most dramatic television appearance of the decade, the cameras snapped PC Trevor Locke, smashing a window and hanging outside, revolver in hand, gasping for fresh air, trying to escape the fire gas inside. An SAS operative grabbed Locke by the shoulders and hauled the policeman back into the gas-filled room, manhandling him onto the landing and shoving Locke towards the stairs. SAS control had radioed the soldiers on the first floor and told them about Sim Harris being stuck on the balcony with flames raging in the room behind him. A soldier ducked into the ambassador's office, but it wasn't Sim Harris that he immediately saw. Through the smoke, walking toward him with a gun in hand was Abbas. He was clearly wounded and struggling to walk. Without pause, the soldier fired a long, sustained burst of shots to finish him off. Abbas fell backward into the darkness. The live television news broadcast around the world images of a terrified man squatting on the front balcony, flames billowing above him. It was Sim Harris, stuck and in peril, trapped on the balcony. Inside the embassy, Trevor Locke was being thrown down the stairs by a human chain of SAS men lining the stairs, down to the back door of the building. They each hurled him to the next man, Locke thanking each of them as they grabbed him. Within seconds, he was standing on the back lawn of the embassy. PC Locke is alive and well, the radio chattered. He is a great credit to the Metropolitan Police. Applause broke out in the Cobra meeting room. The orders were to restrain every civilian emerging from the embassy until formally identified. An exception was made for PC Locke, who was led away to a waiting van of the Police Special Patrol Group. As Locke climbed into the police van, he thanked the police for their incredible assault on the building. One officer replied, "That wasn't us, you stupid wanker. That was the SAS." Hassan burst into the telex room, machine gun in hand. He was looking for the hostages. But it wasn't innocent civilians that he came face to face with. The bullet from the SAS operative's gun entered Hassan's skull beneath his left ear and emerged from his right temple, along with much of his brains. "Are there any terrorists in here?" screamed the soldier. Abbas Falahi, Ron Morris, and Ghulam Ali Afrooz waved their hands and shouted, "British! British! British! I am British!" Afrooz yelled, "Diplomat!" and waved a white handkerchief. "Who are the terrorists?" the soldier shouted, and Afrooz pointed to Mackie, who was stood against the wall with his hands up. "Student! Student!" Mackie shouted. Just then a soldier leaned out of Roya's office window, and he saw Sim Harris cowering on the neighbouring balcony, trying to duck from the flames pouring from the window. "Come over here, mate!" shouted the operative, beckoning with a gloved hand. Harris didn't hesitate. He put one foot on the side of the balcony and leapt, clearing over the embassy flagpole and down onto the edge of the next balcony over, where the soldier caught him and dragged him in through the remains of the window. Like a scene from an action movie, witnessed by millions the world over. The SAS operatives were now hurling the rest of the hostages down the stairs in the same way that they had handled PC Locke. From man to man, like sacks of potatoes, no hesitation, just get them down and out onto the grass at the rear of the embassy building. As they got to the grass, each were tied with cable ties, fastening their hands behind their backs, and they were laid face down on the grass until they could be identified. There were now more than 20 of them out there. Then, at that moment, Ali emerged onto the lawn and lay face down next to the four women hostages. "No," said Roya. The only hostages left in the telex room were the two most seriously injured, Ahmad Dodgar and Ghulam Ali Afrooz. Dodgar, the medical assistant, had lost a lot of blood and was now only half conscious. Two soldiers chairlifted him by placing linked hands under his backside and hauling him out. Mackie was being frisked by the soldiers in the telex room. "Are you a terrorist?" shouted an operative in Arabic. Mackie did not answer. The soldier forced him to the floor with his arms stretched out in a T position. "Are you a terrorist?" shouted the operative in English this time. Mackie just stared at him. At that moment, Mackie pulled his arms in toward his body as if to reach for something underneath his stomach. The SAS soldier assumed he was reaching for a weapon or a grenade, so he emptied five rounds into the small of Mackie's back. The wounded gunman rolled onto his right side, where another soldier poured a burst of gunfire into his face. Amongst the last of the hostages being manhandled down the stairs was a tall man with an afro hairstyle and cowboy boots. Faisal had put up the collar of his green combat jacket to cover the lower part of his face. In the chaos, he had joined the end of the evacuation line unnoticed. As the soldiers were passing Faisal down the stairs, one of them recognized his face from the terrorist pictures he had studied prior to the assault. "That man is a terrorist," he shouted. The next soldier along the line roughly threw Faisal down the stairs head first. "That's one of the fuckers there," said another soldier. Moving from one hostage to the next, the SAS organizer came to a young dark-haired man wearing light-colored chinos and a jacket laying amongst the four women. His wrists were securely tied, his face buried in the grass. "What is your name?" he asked. "And do you speak English?" "Student," the man replied. "I am student." But Harris turned his head and spotted that he was Ali. "He's one of them," screamed Harris. "He's one of the terrorists." Two SAS men in black seized Ali, pulling his bound hands and lifting him off the ground. Ali was screaming with fright. As Ali was dragged back into the burning building, one of the female hostages pleaded with the soldiers not to hurt him, as he had treated them well. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher had specifically given the order to the SAS to eliminate all of the gunmen. But that being said, the soldiers ultimately decided to unceremoniously carry Ali off, upside down, and handed him over to the police special patrol group waiting behind the embassy. They later commented that he was unarmed and terrified. He posed no threat at that moment, so they spared his life. The SAS operation had been a complete and dramatic success. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady, breathed a huge sigh of relief as she headed for the Cobra meeting room. Four fire engines, which had been waiting a few streets away for the all clear, now screeched into Prince's Gate, and torrents of water were soon pouring into the embassy through the flaming windows front and back. The freed hostages were hauled to their feet and escorted out of the side gate and led onto a road lined with ambulances. The SAS climbed into a series of waiting black vans. Their job was done. The police could deal with the rest. The operation ended officially at 7:34 p.m. and the SAS quietly slipped away. Operation Nimrod had lasted just 11 minutes. Prince Andrew arrived 21 minutes later to thank everyone.
Epilogue.
The subsequent party at Regent's Park Barracks that evening was rowdy and boisterous. Mrs. Thatcher arrived at 8:37 p.m, accompanied by Willie Whitelaw and her husband Dennis, to find the SAS in full victory celebration. They were still wearing their combat gear, faces streaked black with paint, shouting, laughing and singing. Each man with several bottles of alcohol in their hands, the air thick with testosterone. Thatcher walked and chatted amongst the men, fully at ease and comfortable with the rowdy bunch. Whitelaw, however, was slightly surprised at the wild group chugging beer and cheering like football hooligans. Thatcher posed for photographs with the soldiers, who re-donned their balaclavas. At 9 p.m, one of the men wheeled in a television and turned on the news, which replayed the dramatic footage of the assault. The men settled down to watch themselves for the first time. At that moment, someone with a large bouffant hairdo was obscuring the screen from the men at the back. SAS operative John McAleese, a confident and outspoken Scotsman, shouted, "Oi, down at the front, move your fucking head." The person with the hairdo obediently ducked out of the way and apologised. No one had ever spoken to Margaret Thatcher like that before.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.